We begin our series of studies this week under the general theme, the things that matter most. I find in my own discipleship that I have a great deal of information which is fed every day, through the week, through the benefit of ecclesial activities and fellowship together, that there's a great deal of information and encouragement that comes from these sources. But the problem which I think we have is to use that information at the appropriate time. That is, that there is a focus and a priority to what we know is the right thing to do, so that when there is a situation in our life, when there is a condition, a problem, a temptation, we have before us at our immediate disposal the divine principles which will help us to do the right thing. So we look at this general subject then, the things that matter most, under this general outline. How is it that we can keep before us, in our minds, in our heads, in our consciousness, the things that matter most? The critical principles, the vital principles that will help us to do the right things before God. My thinking was started on the subject some years ago by something which happened, which you will understand immediately as I describe the situation, where there was a condition, there was an event taking place, and something else happened which brought about a complete incongruous situation. Now let me describe it to you. I had to attend a funeral. It was not of a brother or sister, but it was a funeral which I felt obliged to attend. And I arrived at the funeral home on public transportation. And after the funeral, I was asked to go to the graveside, and I said I'd be pleased to do so, but I had no way of getting there. And so I was invited to ride with someone who was a member of the funeral home, someone who worked at the funeral parlor. So I took my seat in the car, and this man was a very friendly, chatty individual, and we started to ride toward the cemetery, and he put the radio on. And it happened to be at the time when the professional baseball team in Toronto, Toronto Blue Jays, were playing a critical series with another team. And this was very important to him. So he put the radio on, and he starts to listen to the ball game. And he gets very much into it. The Toronto Blue Jays are losing, and this causes some distress, and he has to comment to me about this. And I'm in this situation, having just listened to a funeral service and joined into the seriousness of this occasion. And for him, of course, it's an everyday job. He does it 3 or 4 times a day, and he has he does not join in all the seriousness of this with every person who comes, and he thought that I, perhaps not being a family member, could enjoy the Blue Jay game with him. Well, now, what struck me about this was that, on the one hand, just a few minutes before, there had been the most serious and solemn of situations which we could ever face in life, the consideration of death, the end of a person's life, and the attending sadness which goes with that. And just a few moments later, to sit down and with this man listen to the ball score. And it occurred to me that there was no mesh here of the two events. There couldn't be. There was no reality about what was taking place. The ball game meant nothing, absolutely nothing, compared to what we had just experienced and thinking about the loss of a person's life. There was no reality to it. There was no contact in these two things. And I'm sure you've all had the same experience. Not perhaps climbing in a car and listening to a ball game, but as you climb in the car following a funeral service, and you drive down the street and you look at all these people going about their business, and some people in a hurry to get through the processional, and others going in stores to buy things. And you look at that and you say to yourself, well, life carries on to be sure, but For this moment for me, these things are very irrelevant. I'm concentrating on something here which is of great importance and seriousness. Let me give you another example before we turn to the scriptures. We go and we visit someone in a hospital. Person has been asked to go in for tests. They go in for these tests, and he is informed that he has terminal cancer and will die within 3 months. Very sad and serious situation. But we go and visit this person, and we try to bring some good cheer and humor and perspective. We visit this person, we begin our conversation, and all of a sudden he starts to tell us of some of his interests. And this person will have hobbies. Lots of people have hobbies, and they have these hobbies. This man will have a hobby, and he begins to tell us that he's just ordered some stamps, the latest new issue from New Zealand, which has birds on it, and he's very excited about this, and he's going to add this to his stamp collection. Now, we think about that, and we say, well, now, there's a lack of reality to this. This man is going to die. This man is not going to be here in 3 months, and yet he carries on with his interests. He's behaving as if all things continue as they were, that he's just going to continue to enjoy life. He has not understood the seriousness of the situation. His behavior is not consistent with the news which he has just learned that he's going to die within 3 months. It is not what we would expect of a person who has that information. Now, those are two simple examples. We could add to them, I'm sure, from our own experience, where there'd be something very serious happen, and then immediately following that, something that is completely incongruous with what we've just learned. Now, that's the way it is in our spiritual lives. That is exactly the way it is in the affairs of our life as they relate to God, in matters very serious, eternal, as compared with our ordinary domestic lives. We behave very often in a manner which is completely inconsistent with what we know about God and what we know about ourselves. Now, there's some very excellent examples in the Bible of this sort of thing. I'd like to ask you to look at several of them now. First is found in our recent readings in Matthew chapter 18. In the parable of the unforgiving servant. Can we just turn to this in Matthew chapter 18, starting at verse 23. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a certain king which would take account of his servants. And when he had begun to reckon, one was brought unto him which owed him 10,000 talents. But forasmuch as he had not to pay, his Lord commanded him to be sold, and his wife and children, and all that he had, and payment to be made. And the servant therefore fell down and worshipped him, saying, Lord, have patience with me, and I will pay thee all. Then the Lord of that servant was moved with compassion, and loosed him, and forgave him the debt. So we have there that basic initial situation of a man who owed a great deal, had no way to pay this debt, and he was forgiven. Upon appeal, he was forgiven. But the same servant, verse 28, went out and found one of his fellow servants which owed him 100 pence. And he laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, Pay me that thou owest. And his fellow servant fell down at his feet and besought him, saying, The same words, Have patience with me, and I will pay thee all. But he would not, but went and cast him into prison till he should pay the debt. So when his fellow servants saw what was done, they were very sorry, and came and told unto their lord all that was done. Then his lord, after that he had called him, said unto him, O thou wicked servant, I forgave thee all that debt because thou desirest me. Shouldest not thou also have had compassion on thy fellow servant, even as I had pity on thee? Now, when you think of that, we join the indignation of this situation. We look at this and we say, the one man, the first man, has had a great debt forgiven. He's been treated in a kindly and forgiving manner. But when the same opportunity arises for him to behave in the same way, he doesn't. He acts in a very harsh way, an unforgiving way, and he abuses the man who owes him money. And we are angry at this situation, and we're intended to be. We're supposed to feel very harshly toward this man, because there's a lesson here that we're intended to learn about God's forgiveness to us and our forgiveness to others. But do you see here how first something happens and subsequent behavior is not consistent with what has taken place? A very inconsistent response follows a very gracious act of mercy. A most interesting situation there to illustrate the kind of behavior which we ourselves often demonstrate. Now, there's an even more interesting one found later on in Matthew, and we pick this up at Matthew chapter 24. An astounding situation here. Matthew chapter 24 is the commencement of the sermon, the Olivet Prophecy. And it follows the occasions here where Jesus is preparing now in Jerusalem for his own crucifixion. And prior to this, he's gone into the temple and cleansed it, and there's been this very dramatic moment where he intercedes and interrupts the business affairs that are taking place in the temple. Now, he leaves the temple in chapter 24, verse 1. Jesus went out and departed from the temple. And the timing of that, before we go on, if we look at chapter 26, at the end of this discourse, as he follows through chapters 24 and 25 of Matthew, we find in chapter 26, it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said unto his disciples, ye know that after 2 days is the feast of the Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified. So it's 2 days before his crucifixion. That's the point we want to establish. 2 days before his crucifixion, and Jesus has been talking about this for some time with his disciples. He's been in the temple several times. He leaves now, chapter 24, verse 1. Jesus went out and departed from the temple. And his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. Now that is an absolutely amazing situation. That is, for me, just like riding in the car after the funeral and listening to the ball game. Jesus here has been intensive, absolutely intensive in his condemnation of the scribes and Pharisees and hypocrites. And prior to that, he's cleansed the temple. And there's been a whole series of events take place here to demonstrate that Jesus is at the end of his time with mankind. And there's been a great intensity of his message to these people. And he goes out of the temple, and the disciples come to him and start to talk about the buildings. I hope you can see that. It's a picture from a book which we have in Toronto. It gives a general illustration of this temple area. And it's very, very impressive. Very impressive building and environment, this temple area here. We have the temple itself, place of worship here. We have the court of the women next to it. We have the whole temple courtyard. We have the building here at the end where the Sanhedrin would meet. We have the offices of the priests and the very famous gates into this walled area. Very, very impressive structure. Stones here, 10 meters long, which weighed up to 100 tons. And the Jews were very, very impressed with this structure. Herod, in an act of kindness and political expediency, constructed this area here and this temple for these Jews. 46 years it was in construction, from 20 BC to 26 AD. And it wasn't even finished at that time. There was still work going on. And the Jews were very impressed with this, very grateful, as a matter of fact, to have this impressive structure. And the disciples showed Jesus the buildings of the temple. Let's look at the other passages, because they add some interesting facts here. Mark chapter 13. Parallel passages here. Verse 1, Mark 13. And as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples saith unto him, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. What manner of stones and what buildings are here? Huge stones. How did they ever move them? How did they ever position them in the right place to build this beautiful structure? Obviously, the disciples here are impressed. Luke chapter 21. Verse 5, Luke 21, verse 5. And as some spake of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts, he said. The disciples are impressed with the building and the structure. And Jesus says, as for these things which ye behold, the days will come in the which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Can you see here? The mismatch, the total mismatch of what was going on in the life of Jesus and what the apostles, the disciples, should have understood was about to take place. And their reaction. Jesus, after this great intensive period of instruction, walks out of the temple, and the disciples point to the buildings and the stones, and they're impressed. How trite, how insignificant. So we have then this problem in our lives of knowing, understanding great important things to take place, and of which we're part now in this life, the purpose of our lives to do the things of God, only to have commingled in our everyday experience things which are totally irrelevant and to which we give priority. So we need now to look at some helps, some solutions that help us to keep before us the important things, the things that matter most. We need to learn to see with absolute clarity what is important all the time, every day, so that we know how to devote our time, our energy, and our resources. How can we be helped? Let's look at a man who had problems like ourselves with this. The lesson is found in the book of Genesis, chapter 25. Genesis 25. And we have here the family of Jacob. Jacob and Esau and his father, Isaac. And in this situation, the well-known problem which comes into the life of Jacob and Esau, starting at verse 27 of Genesis 25. The boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter and a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Now the situation. Jacob sowed pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint. Therefore was his name called Edom. And Jacob said, Sell me this day thy birthright. And Jacob said, Behold, I am at the point to die, and what profit shall this birthright do to me? And Jacob said, Swear to me this day. And he swore unto him, and sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink, and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Now that is a perfect example of a man who did not understand what was important. He traded his birthright and the great privilege that went with that for a meal. He obviously had things way out of perspective. He did not understand the importance of what he was giving away. Now, I want you to note the meaning of one word here. At the end of verse 34, Esau despised his birthright. And the meaning of that word is this. He undervalued. To despise means to undervalue, to accord little worth to something. He accorded little worth and undervalued his birthright. And that's what we do when we sin. That's what happens when we make the wrong decision, when we're in problem situations. We undervalue the things of God and we trade it for something which is here and now. And when we look at this, we say, this is the action of a foolish man. How could he do so? But he did. He was a man who lived by impulse. He didn't stop and think. He didn't stop and try to understand the relevancy of what he was doing in terms of the great and eternal things. One of the most pathetic passages in the whole of Scripture is the analysis of this situation found in the book of Hebrews, chapter 12. If you turn there, please. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 16. Pick up the thought here. Hebrews 12, verse 16. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. One meal sold his birthright. Now again, I want to give you the meaning of a word, this word profane. Esau is described as a profane person. And Vine's Dictionary gives this meaning of profane. That which lacks all relationship or affinity with God. Someone who is profane lacks a relationship or affinity with God. The sacred is the opposite. To be sacred is to be connected with the things of God. To be profane is to be unconnected with the things of God. And that's what Esau was, unconnected with the things of God. Now he was, of course, in his family. Isaac, Abraham, his whole heritage was part of the things of God. Some of the most important parts of the things of God. But he himself, in his outlook, in his disposition, never considered the things of God to be important. Now, one writer has given us a very interesting analysis here. If you turn back to chapter 11 of Hebrews, verse 1, and pick up this definition of faith. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Two things. Substance of things hoped for, evidence of things not seen. That's what faith has to do with. Now, a writer has given this analysis of Esau. It is said that for Esau, things hoped for were as unsubstantial shadows. They were just vague concepts that had nothing to do with him. Unsubstantial shadows. And things unseen were as things non-existent. Things non-existent. For Esau, the things hoped for is unsubstantial shadows. Things unseen, things not seen, were as things non-existent. Very, very interesting statements there in thinking about Esau. So we have a man here who lives without care and thought and attention to the things of God. And the result of that is that he makes poor choices, poor decisions. And he gave away something which was of great importance to him. Could have changed his life. Now I know that God was behind certain aspects of this, guarding it in unseen ways. But for the man himself, for Esau, who was responsible for his own actions, these were the consequences. For ye know that afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears. Of course he did. When he saw what he lost, any man can see later on, when they can see the consequences of behavior and evaluate it, when he can see it in the cold light of day, of course there will be anguish of spirit. And that's what happens again when we sin. When we're involved in it, it's a great joy. It's something which preoccupies us and has our full attention, and we are there willingly. But afterwards, when we look at it and put it on the table and evaluate it, we are shocked. We are horrified at what we've done and the decisions we may have made. And so it was with Esau. He sought it carefully with tears, and there was no turning back. His actions were irrevocable. He couldn't change it. And he had then to live with the consequences of his behavior. Well, now, a very different man back in Genesis. I ask you to turn to the book of Genesis again, chapter 39. Man Joseph. And we look here at just one incident in his life. Joseph, who left his family at a very young age, goes to a foreign country without companionship, without family, without support, without religious input. Here he is having to make important decisions. And the decision we look at now in Genesis 39 has to do with the temptation to commit an immoral act with his master's wife. Verse 7. It came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said unto his master's wife, "Behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hand. There is none greater in this house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Now, when you consider that situation and the intensity of that temptation, without any help, without any guidance, other than the training which he'd had prior to his life in Egypt, we consider that situation that Joseph had to face at this time. Look how strong he is. Look what instinct drives him. He refuses to be involved in this act for two reasons. Number one, he will not sin against God. He understands the moral principle in relationship to the God of heaven. He understands that. It is firmly in his mind, and he can draw on it immediately. And secondly, out of respect for his master, he will not touch his master's wife. Two principles there. One having to do with common decency and respect in the affairs of this world, and one to do with our understanding and our responsibility to the God of heaven. And those principles were right before Joseph when he needed them. And he could apply them then immediately in that situation. God's way took priority. The things that mattered most were right there. And he could behave in a way that was consistent with the situation. Can we turn now to a condition in the life of Jesus? Luke chapter 4. The temptation of Jesus. And you will be aware of the three temptations which he had. And we want only to observe here that Jesus had the same type of situation to contend with that Joseph did. He is tempted. He is tempted to do things which would have been inconsistent with his calling, with what God required of him. And he doesn't have time to debate the issue. He doesn't say, "Well, come back tomorrow or next week and I'll give you my answer." He has to respond immediately to the temptation. He doesn't have anyone to talk to, no one to give him counsel. He isn't there with a briefcase full of books where he can sit down with reference books and turn up
in the scrolls, the law of God, and think about it and test it and be sure. There's no time for that. He has at his immediate disposal, before his mind, the things, the principles which he needs to respond to the temptations in this situation. Now that reflects a man who is well equipped to deal with life. And it shows us the kind of model which we ourselves need to learn to design for ourselves. We need, whatever our temptations, whatever our situation, to equip ourselves with the tools, with the divine principles that will help us to live, to survive, and to act in a way consistent with the great eternal principles we understand. Well, now, I'd like you to look at some situations in our ordinary everyday life. And I'm going to put these on a slide here. That's the right way. Look at this set of conditions which we have here. We've headed this, that value is influenced by circumstance. We have here a number of conditions, a number of situations. Some of them are quite amusing, and they're all very interesting, I think. If we said that a man had a gold coin, I don't know whether everybody here is a coin collector or invests in coins, but if we had a gold coin that was very, very valuable, and we had that coin in a place where there are other people who are interested in coins, that might be very valuable. In circumstance A, that coin is very valuable. But if we found ourselves in the middle of a jungle, a gold coin is absolutely useless to us. Doesn't matter how rare it is, it might be the only specimen of its kind in the world. Might be in perfect condition, it might be prized by people who understand the value of that coin, but in the jungle, it's absolutely worthless to us. We're trying to survive the snakes and looking for water and food and so forth. The coin is useless. Talk about an air conditioner. If we're living in Florida and the temperatures are very hot and humid and so forth, an air conditioner is very valuable to us. We'd love to have one. We'd pay a good price to have one, and we'd make sure it was maintained to meet our needs. But if we live in the North Pole, an air conditioner is of no use to us. Now you see what's happening here. It depends on the circumstance. We understand the circumstance, things which we have and own will have a very different value depending on where we are. Matches on a camping trip are of great value. We're going to Manitoulin Bible School next week. And I can assure you, I have a great supply of matches there because that is how Sister Joan will cook my meals. It's very important that I ensure she has dry matches. But in the city, I will go from now until next year before I use a match. We have an electric stove, and there's absolutely no reason for me to ever use a match in the city. Water. We don't think about water. We turn on the tap, and there's a bit of water, and wash our clothes, do the dishes and take a nice cold drink. There's no thought about water. But when we're in the desert, water is priceless. We'll search very, very eagerly to find a place where there's water. And if we have some water or supply water with us, it'll be rationed out to be sure. We're not careless with the water in the desert. A tiny plastic part. Have you ever broken down your car on the highway and you're 50 miles from a gas station either way, and all that's required is some little piece of plastic to make that car go? And the value of it is 50 cents in the gas station. Little tiny part worth 50 cents. But out there, you'd pay $5, $10, $50 for that so that you can get on with your trip and get your family to where you want to go. That's what you'll pay for it when the man drives out in a truck and puts it in for you. $50, little 50 cent piece of plastic, so forth. The Bible has the same value to us no matter where we are, no matter what our situation in life is, what our age, what our health, whatever we're involved with. The Bible is priceless. That's what we need to see. We need to understand this point of circumstance. Now let's look at another chart. Chart 2. We have two situations here. Situation A, a normal, healthy person. That's most of us here. Normal, healthy people. And circumstance B is a person about to die. What is the importance of the things we list there to those two different types of people? We described here the resources which a man might accumulate. A large estate, $1 million in cash, vacation cottage in a boat, a prominent career, things of the world. And people work very hard to get those things, to acquire in their own lives these kinds of things, to make life enjoyable and comfortable and interesting. And when we're normal and healthy and we can use those things, that's terrific. We're involved with them, we're very pleased to have them, and we give them a lot of attention and priority in our lives. They're very important to us. How does a person about to die feel about a large estate or about $1 million cash? He's lying on his deathbed. He knows he's about to expire. How does he feel about those things? The same way as the man who's ready to go, get in the car and use these things? Of course not. To think about that is to say, well, there are different circumstances there. And naturally, the one man feels very differently than the other. And we should have an understanding of that difference all the time in our daily living. We're not promised tomorrow by God. We're not promised the quality of tomorrow, even if we make it till tomorrow. Today we can walk around and do things and spend money and go swimming and boating and do all kinds of things. Tomorrow, if by God's blessing we live, we might not be able to walk. We might not have the use of our arms. Or we might not be able to breathe very good so that we're active. We don't know what tomorrow has. Therefore, it's incumbent on us that we walk circumspectly, to use the scriptural word, to walk circumspectly, redeeming the time. There should be no difference between today and tomorrow in terms of our perspective toward these things. We are here by God's blessing and mercy. Faithful discipleship is valued just as much today as it is tomorrow. It does not matter on our health or condition or vitality. Whatever takes place, discipleship before God and a relationship before God will have the same value and perspective by the Almighty. So we use then these common examples to show the need to bring some order, to bring some perspective into our lives about how we spend our energy and time and resources, about learning to recognize what matters most. I would like to conclude then with one passage in the second letter of Paul to the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Second Corinthians 4, verse 18. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Now that gives us one of the very important helps and principles in the Bible to help us keep things straight. That if we can learn the principle that everything that's around us, while we can see it, is only temporary, it is not going to survive the kingdom age, it's going to change or be obliterated, removed completely. If we can learn that principle that what's around us is not going to be here, and yet things which we cannot see, great, important, divine changes will come upon this earth which are going to make it a far better place to be, which are going to bring about a world which is infinitely better than what we could ever imagine. Things which we cannot see are going to be here, and they're going to be real, and they're going to be eternal. That is one of the principles which will help us then to establish this issue of a priority and learning to recognize what matters most. Tomorrow, God willing, we will take a look at the principle remembering the law of God.